Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 310. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. Got a great bunch of guys with me and another great topic lined up for you today and for your edification. Let me introduce to you first our regulars. We have Jeff Waddington, who is stated supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to speak with you once again.
Oh, it is great to be here, especially on the topic we will be talking about.
We also have with us today Nick Batzig, who is a church planner with the PCA at New Covenant Presbyterian Church in Richmond Hill, Georgia. Welcome back, Nick. It's great to speak with you as well.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be back on.
Yeah, we have a great program lined up for you, and we're finally getting into some of these excellent books that are coming out from Reformation Heritage Books. We're going to speak about one in just a minute. Let me introduce to you today our very important guest. We're very pleased to welcome to the program Dr. Wayne Speer, who is Professor Emeritus of Systematic Theology at Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program, Dr. Speer. It's wonderful to speak with you this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to be talking about Dr. Speer's book. It was a dissertation written several years ago, but now it's been brought to print and made and accessible through Reformation Heritage Books. We're speaking about Covenanted Uniformity in Religion, subtitled The Influence of the Scottish Commissioners on the Ecclesiology of the Westminster Assembly. This is in the Studies on the Westminster Assembly series. Just a fine piece of work, an excellent book, and a binding and a volume to suit it from RHB. And we're going to be speaking about this important subject in just a moment. But first, we do need to mention Christ the Center is listener-supported. We do encourage you all to visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. We need your help in order to continue recording all these programs and distributing them free of charge. We love doing it, but you need to help us today, so please visit us online. Once again, reformedforum.org/donate. We thank you so much for all of your support of everything we do at Reformed Forum, and especially this particular program, Christ the Center. Now, I would like to just begin by thanking you, Dr. Speer, for joining us and also for putting this your pen to the paper and speaking about this important subject. Ecclesiology is one of those topics that is not as important in the broader church as we think it ought to be. But us Presbyterians, especially the old school variety and those who are interested in the Westminster Assembly and our standards, understand how significant this issue is. So we're planning to open up this book and learn how the ecclesiology of the Westminster Assembly was formulated and how it was debated and how it was discussed. Dr. Speer, I was wondering if you could tell us the prevailing, perhaps not the prevailing view, but what is the common view with regards to the Scottish commissioners to the assembly? It's typically thought that they had a large influence. What do many scholars think, or what is the general assumption about their influence on the Westminster Assembly?
Well, there's a very common view that they had leverage in the Assembly because of the need that the English Parliament had for military assistance from Scotland in the civil war that was going on at that time. And so it is the common view that the Scots were able, by that leverage, to impose their will about the government of the church on the unwilling English. And that's one of the things that my book addresses, that thesis about the influence of the Scottish commissioners.
Dr. Speer, can you tell us, just for our listeners' sake, a little bit about the background of the assembly leading into this, and just very briefly the relationship between the Scottish constituency and the English commissioners to the assembly?
Yes, as I've said, the Assembly met during the Civil War in England. That was a conflict between Charles I and his supporters on the one hand, and the Parliament on the other, which at that time was largely dominated by Puritans, and because of Charles's policy of promoting absolute power for his monarchy and his policies toward the church, there was a general uprising in England against him. And when he tried to arrest the leaders of the House of Commons in 1642, civil war broke out. In the first year of the war, it did not go well for the Parliament, and so they sought the help of the Scottish commissioners. I should say before that that the Parliament had decided to remove the bishops from their role in the Church of England because of their strong support of the policies of Charles I. And so the Church of England was essentially without a government, and the Parliament called the Westminster Assembly into existence to give them advice with regarding the government and the worship of the Church of England, so that it would be, as the Puritans said, a further reformed church than had been the case at the first Reformation of it.
And I've always been fascinated by the fact that the assembly was ecumenical Protestant council fueled by political civil war, because I think oftentimes from our 21st century understanding of what was produced at Westminster, we often think of it as this Presbyterian sort of monolithic, very separate church and state thing happening in church history, but it's actually a very complicated issue. Did that have any bearing on how the Scottish delegates viewed the assembly on the whole? Any of those issues, that there was war going on and that it was not Presbyterian, but it was more ecumenical in a Protestant sense?
Well, it was ecumenical in the sense that there were a variety of views in the assembly about church government. They were more united in their theological views that came to expression in the Confession of Faith. But it's generally said, and correctly, that there were four different viewpoints represented in the assembly. There were people who were convinced Presbyterians out of a heritage of in the Puritan movement of a promotion of a Presbyterian church government. There were pragmatic Presbyterians who didn't like the government that they had had, but were not in principle committed to Presbyterianism. There was a small but vocal group of independents who were not in favor of a national church, but wanted congregational church government. And a small but influential group of Erastians, whose view was that the civil government ought to determine what the government of the church would be. And so the Scots had to deal with all of those viewpoints in their participation in the assembly.
Mm-hmm. What was the original intent behind calling the assembly? Obviously, we have all these different views and people that need to work together toward an end goal. What was that original intent, and where, when it was called, did the people convening the assembly, where did they think they were going?
Well, the initial purpose, and it was set by the Parliament in the ordinance that called the assembly into being, the initial purpose was, first of all, to determine what kind of government would be in the Church of England and also in Scotland and Ireland, to replace the government by bishops. And because there had been intense controversies about worship, the ordinance also said that they would give attention to reforming the liturgy of the church as well. So it was to the attempt to move the church in a more Puritan direction, particularly with regard to government and worship.
Now, the condition of the Church of England at the time of the calling of the assembly, that you've discussed, Dr. Spear, some of those the different views that are represented at the assembly, but the history of the dispute, the desire on the part of the Puritan Party for further reformation to bring the Church of England, say, into conformity to what's happening in Scotland and then on the continent, that goes back. Really, I mean, the disputes go back to the time of, I suppose you could say, Henry VIII and then his son Edward, but then there are real issues with regard to Elizabeth I, and then from the men that sat on the throne after her. What are the, maybe we can turn to a more positive discussion here. What were the goals? Say, we grant that the English are in need of the Parliament is in need of the assistance of the Scottish military in order to wage its campaign against the king. What are the goals, say, of the Scottish commissioners, or let's say the General Assembly in Scotland when it sends the commissioners? What are the goals that they have?
Well, I think the title of the book expresses that pretty well. As the English sought the help of Scotland, they drew up the treaty or the document that would be the basis of their cooperation, and that was the Solemn League and Covenant of 1643 that called, as it said, for the preservation of the Reformed religion in Scotland and the reformation of the Church of England. So the Solemn League and Covenant had the goal to bring the Church of England into conformity with the Church of Scotland, which had already successfully revolted against Charles I and established there in 1638 and following, reestablish, I should say, Presbyterian church government. And so the Scots were deeply committed in principle to the Presbyterian church government, which they had, and also to the worship practices, which then prevailed in the Church of England, and it was their aim to see England change, really, to conform to the Scottish model.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. Were there also some commissioners that were afraid of losing the ground that they had already gained in their own country?
Well, that was a real threat. They had been, of course, in military conflict with England in the so-called Bishop Wars of 1639 and 1640, and had Charles been successful in the Civil War, it would undoubtedly have been his aim, and he would have taken steps to reestablish Episcopal church government in Scotland and to overthrow the revolution. So they had real fear of that.
Now, when Parliament called for the assembly, they had asked pastors to pray publicly for the Lord's blessing on it. But at the same time, you write that the king condemned the assembly and threatened fines. Could you describe this tight spot that this situation provided for many of the local pastors? How did they deal with this scenario, being torn between two authorities telling them to do opposite things?
Well, as I say in the book, they faced a dilemma in that. And so depending on whether they were sympathetic with the Puritan movement or not, that would have been reflected in their response to the king's prohibition and to the call for prayer. So the congregation would have had an idea of that. But it was a very significant decision for them, because there had already been some pretty severe persecution of the Puritans. And again, if the king had been successful in the war, they would have suffered the consequences of their resistance to the king's prohibition.
How was the assembly originally organized? I mean, in terms of just the practical items, the rules, the officers, the procedures. You know, when we go to presbytery meetings, we have bylaws and we have a form of church government, and sometimes we just take those things for granted. But when the assembly comes together, they have to start with something. How did they go about organizing the assembly, and what were their thoughts as they did that?
Well, the parliament gave them rules and as to how they were to proceed. There was a quorum that was required. There were 120 ministers who were called to be a part of the assembly, along with 20 members of the House of Commons and 10 members of the House of Lords. It should be understood that it wasn't a regular ecclesiastical assembly. It was rather an advisory commission for the parliament. And so the lay members from the parliament, commons and the House of Lords, were not elders in the church, but they were representatives of the government. The actual attendance at the assembly, because a number named in the ordinance obeyed the king and did not attend, so the usual attendance was somewhere around 60, and of those they required a quorum of 40 in order to do business. They had rules not unlike our modern church assemblies. Decisions were by a majority of one. A simple majority could approve a proposition. They debated as to whether or not they should limit debate, and they refused to do that, and so the debates were very long and complicated, and people were often frustrated by that. I have in the book some description of their committee structure, which I could talk about. I don't know if that would be of help to people or not.
Absolutely.
That was the next question we wanted to ask.
Okay. Well, I think this was a learning process, and part of my perspective is that when they were working on the form of presbyterial church government, which is what my book deals with, their organization was a real hindrance to them. The assembly was divided into three general committees. Every member of the assembly was a part of one of those committees. And then as they worked on the form of church government, each committee dealt with the same subject matter. They followed the pattern in that of the Synod of Dort. And what that resulted in practically was that the different committees would bring in reports at different times that would be on the same subject matter as the other committees. So they would have debated the report of one committee and made some decisions, and then another committee would bring in a report on the same matter, and they would be led back over the whole debate again. And so it greatly retarded their progress. Later on, when they came to work on the Confession of Faith, there was a small drafting committee that did the initial writing, and that produced a much more coherent document. It went from the drafting committee then to the three general committees that made revisions and then came to the whole assembly. But the Confession of Faith is a much more coherent document because they had a better procedure as to the committee structure of the assembly. And I mention two other kinds of committees. There were a number of accommodation committees that sought language that would suit members of the assembly that had still some differences, and they tried to get language that could satisfy a large number of the people. And for some people, compromise is a bad word, but that was a procedure of the assembly to try to seek common ground. And then there were at least two editing committees that put the document into final form. And part of what I say in the book is that those committees did not do very good work, so that there are a lot of places where the language is not clear. They took sentences that were adopted in one context and put them in another context, and so the result was a kind of mosaic of bits and pieces, not always put together in a fully coherent way.
You know, there are so many interesting people that were involved in the assembly and so many bright minds, just some giants of Reformed and Presbyterian thought. Could you describe for us some of the Scottish commissioners? We have several figures people may be familiar with, guys like Samuel Rutherford and George Gillespie. You know, maybe could you describe for us just a couple of these guys and their general influence upon the assembly?
Yeah, I'll say briefly about the four ministers. Alexander Henderson was the oldest of them and clearly the leader of the delegation. He had been the moderator of the General Assembly in 1638 that successfully revolted against the bishops and the king. And he was clearly the statesman of the group. George Gillespie was the youngest minister, about 26 years of old age at the beginning, and an especially gifted debater. And so there's a famous incident in which he was debating with John Selden, who was an expert in biblical law and an Erastian. And Selden said at the end of that debate that this young man has destroyed in a few hours the work of a lifetime. So very gifted debater. Samuel Rutherford, the author of the famous devotional letters that have been published many times, was also very active in debate and also writing books during the time of the assembly. Robert Bailey, according to the minutes, never spoke in the assembly, but was very active behind the scenes, writing letters to seek support from the continent and from Scotland. And so his writings, the letters and journals of Robert Bailey, are one of the primary sources for the history of the Westminster Assembly.
Now, we have the minutes. There's some great work that has come out from Dr. Chad Van Dixhorn, and we have these journals and other historical sources that give us a clue into some of the official proceedings. Were there any unofficial or private ways that the Scottish commissioners influenced the assembly? And if so, how do we come to know about those things?
Well, we know a lot about that from the letters and journals of Bailey.
Yeah.
And Scottish commissioners did not have voting power in the assembly. They were what we would call consultative members, but they were very active. They were writing books and pamphlets while they were there. They had the right to sit on any committee meeting that they wanted to participate in, and did that often, and were very active in those deliberations in committee. They're very active in the debates of the assembly itself. So they were lobbying, we might say, a lot behind the scenes. They also, when they came to the Directory for Worship, did some of the drafting of that document. So behind the scenes, they were very active in private conversations and in committee meetings and in writing materials relative to what the assembly was debating.
You know, one of the most important things here is the form of church government, and this really gives us a clue into what they've eventually came to agreement upon in terms of ecclesiology, the very essence of your book here. When we open up the Westminster Assembly's form of church government, we come to the preface. What does the preface itself really clue us into? What does it say about the assembly's view of church power and authority, for instance?
Well, I think at the beginning of the program, there was mention about centering on Christ, and the preface certainly does that. It's a collage, a putting together of a number of biblical passages, making the point that church government flows from Jesus Christ, the head of the church. So it has Isaiah chapter 9 about the government being upon his shoulders. Matthew 28, all authority is given to me in heaven and earth. It has Ephesians 1, the exaltation of Christ above all might and power and so on. And Ephesians 4 about the ascended Christ giving the gift of officers to his church. And so the document begins in that Christ-centered way, tracing the government of the church back to the authority of the head of the church, which is Christ.
Dr. Speer, before we get into a discussion of church offices and the graded courts, could you characterize the views, or contrast the views of the Scottish commissioners and then the resulting form of government that we see coming out of the assembly on the nature of the church, say specifically visible versus invisible, whether something like membership was considered important?
The document itself, the form of church government, understandably focuses upon the visible church because they're talking about what the government of that church will be. The use of that language, however, reflects their acceptance of the distinction between the church as visible and invisible, as they had found it in Calvin, and it was a part of their theological perspective. But for that document, they were focusing upon the church as visible.
Right.
Now, I think for modern American Presbyterians, at least, it's important to understand that they were aiming at a national church. They had that in Scotland and in England. They wanted a national Presbyterian church that would be virtually coextensive with the whole society. And so as they talked about membership in the church, they talked about it in terms of what they called visible saints. And the discussion in the minutes makes clear that by that expression, they meant those who profess the true Christian religion and who have life that is free of overt sin or scandal. They debated as to whether or not a profession of saving faith should be required or not, and their decision was negative about that. And that goes along with their vision of the church being virtually coextensive with the nation. The independents were those who would have preferred requiring at least profession of one's saving trust in Christ, but the assembly as a whole did not adopt that position.
So, you know, seeing that they have particular views about church authority and also understandings about the church as a whole and its nature, obviously we would come to then does that authority become exercised in various levels, either at assemblies and particularly in the local church? What offices did the form of church government recognize? And were there a distinction between ordinary and extraordinary offices?
Yes, as they looked at Ephesians 4, they declared that the offices of apostle, prophet, and evangelist were extraordinary offices. They had a rather extensive discussion of the office of apostle because of the view that the bishops were the successors of the apostles. They didn't have much discussion of the other two extraordinary offices, and there was a reason for that. So they followed Calvin in denominating four permanent or ordinary offices, that of pastor, teacher, what they called church governors or elders, and deacons.
You make a really fascinating point in the book about the nature of proof texts, and specifically with Acts chapter 15, which is a chapter that many of us point to defend and the warrant for Presbyterianism. It's the passage that talks about the Council of Jerusalem. But you make this fascinating point that they want to use it to defend a present-day and modern Presbyterianism. In other words, that it's normative for the church today. But then others were attempting to use the same passage to defend apostolic authority, and that put them into somewhat of a quandary. Is this a typical thing when we're dealing with different committees and so many different minds that they have to really conform and unify not only the final product, but also the verses and the scriptural references that back up their final form of government?
Well, they had a very extensive debate on the question about the proposition was that many congregations may be under one presbyterial government. And they did that primarily drawing from the examples of the church in Jerusalem and the church in Ephesus. And the argument was to the effect that there were too many people in both of those places to be assembled in one congregation. There must have been a plurality of congregations, and yet there is reference to the church singular in Jerusalem, and so they argued that there must have been one government over the multiple congregations mm-hmm. in Jerusalem, and they argued the same for Ephesus in a little less detail. And the example of Acts 15 they took as, because it applied not only to Jerusalem, but to Antioch and to the other churches to whom the letter from the Council of Jerusalem was sent, that those churches in different places were under a single government of presbyters who came together to make decisions.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the interesting points here is this office of doctor or teacher. Could you describe some of the similarities and differences that particular office has with the office of pastor? I know in the OPC, for instance, we have one office and it's the office of minister, and then there are different functions or installations that one can exercise. How did the assembly understand these two offices, the offices of pastor and doctor?
Well, they were following Calvin in this, who took the passage in Ephesians 4, which mentions pastors and teachers, that that mention indicated that there were two distinct offices. For Calvin and for Knox, the place where the doctor or teacher served was not in the worship services of the church or in the church directly, but rather in the schools. And so both in Geneva and in Scotland, they envisioned a system of schools in which the teaching would be done under the authority of the church by those who held the office of teacher or doctor. And particularly those who were preparing for the ministry would be taught by such people. The distinction between pastor and teacher was not very clear in these earlier forms and also in the assembly. For example, the assembly gave to the teacher the power of administering the sacraments, and the Scots had some objection to that. It was not their practice in Scotland, but it tended to blur the distinction. Robert Henderson has written a book called The Teaching Office in the Reformed Tradition, and it's an excellent study of the ambiguity about the office of a teacher or doctor. And most Presbyterians today, I think, would say in the exegesis of Ephesians 4, 11, and 12 that there's a different grammatical structure there, which indicates that it's referring to pastor slash teacher, not to two distinct offices. And in fact, the office of teacher or doctor has virtually disappeared from church government in all Reformed denominations.
Could you very briefly talk to our listeners a little bit about how they handle the issue of pastors and elders, or what I think the phrase is used in the Directory of Public Worship, other ministers, and kind of how that dovetails into our understanding of two office and three office when it comes to eldership?
Yes, well, perhaps two parts to the answer to that. The English, although they had literature coming from Thomas Cartwright and Walter Travers, which set forth Presbyterian church government, the English had had no experience of the office of ruling elder, and so there was considerable uncertainty, if not resistance, to having the office of ruling elder in the church. And that's reflected in the language of the fourth form of church government, which uses the language other church government, other church governors, and then says commonly called elders in Reformed churches. But there was a good bit of disagreement and uncertainty. And in the end, the office of ruling elder was really established not on the basis of a clear biblical requirement, but as something that might be done and was recommended to be done, but not required. The assembly clearly has a two-office view of the eldership. The most concrete expression of that was the fact that to the extent that there was biblical warrant for ruling elders, it was derived from 1 Timothy 5:17, which speaks about those who rule but do not teach. And then Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 12, which speak about gifts for governing in distinction from gifts for teaching or preaching. And so they grounded the ruling elder office on those three passages and not on 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, which they took as referring only to ministers. So they clearly had a two-office view of the office of pastor. The office of elder.
Now, we have several other issues here that are fascinating, and you have a bunch of chapters in this book that deal with a number of important issues, a chapter on the local church, one on governmental assemblies, and then one final one on ordination. I think just in our remaining time, it would be well worth the time to discuss the Scottish commissioners and their desires regarding the assembly on these particular issues and how they went about influencing them. We think about a guy like George Gillespie. What were some of his major concerns, and were those accomplished? If George Gillespie looks at the final form of church government, do you think he would have been satisfied?
Well, the conclusion that I draw in the book is that the Scots got less than they desired as in their participation in the assembly. I've identified 14 issues that were important to them that they would have wanted to have established on the basis of what they called divine right, in other words, required by the scripture. And they got of those 14 issues, they got only two that were established on the basis of God's requirement in the scripture. The others that were important to them were affirmed, but in a less authoritative way. That is, something that was either recommended or permitted, but not required. And so my general conclusion from that, going back to the view that the Scottish commissioners dominated the assembly because of the military situation, that they were not successful in achieving what they wanted to achieve. And this enumeration of the points important to them and the basis on which those points were established, I think, is evidence that they were very active and vigorous in pushing their point of view, but were not successful fully in achieving what they wanted to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. How was the overall reception of the form of church government in Scotland then? Not just the commissioners, but the country, the nation as a whole. How was it received over there?
Well, it's that's an interesting story. The fact of the matter is, historically, that the Westminster Assembly's efforts to establish Presbyterian church government failed in England. The Parliament never approved the form of church government as a document, though they took some components of it and put them into an ordinance regarding church government. And set up some presbyteries in London and elsewhere, but that lasted a very short time because Oliver Cromwell came to power because of his military success. And since he was a Congregationalist, he saw to it that Presbyterian government was not established in England. And so the document was never approved in England and was not applied there in any significant way. The document was approved in Scotland, but soon after that, Cromwell controlled Scotland, and then after the Restoration, Episcopal church government was reestablished in Scotland. When the Revolution settlement came in 1688 and Scotland became Presbyterian again, it did so not on the basis of the form of church government, but it went back to what was called the Grand Charter of Presbytery of 1592. So the document did not, even in Scotland, have continuing authoritative status. However, it was published in a very popular collection of documents, which we still use today. And because of that, I think became associated in the minds of the Scottish people with the Confession of Faith and with the catechisms. And there are some later acknowledgments of the form of church government as belonging to the constitution of the Church of Scotland and of some of the dissenting churches. But it was not by formal approval, but by that popular association with the Confession of Faith in the often published collection of documents.
Dr. Spear, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a few works besides your own book that you would recommend on the history of the Assembly, and maybe I was wondering what you thought particularly about Warfield's short work on the Westminster Assembly.
Yeah, Warfield's work is quite excellent, I think, and he worked, he did have knowledge of the minutes of the Assembly, which, by the way, have been, for the first 2 years of the Assembly, have been unpublished until last year in the work done by Chad Van Dixhorn and others. Warfield's work is excellent. Of course, he wrote it in the debate with Charles Briggs and with special attention to the doctrine of Scripture in the Westminster Confession. The chairman of my committee, Dr. Robert Paul, was, at the time I was studying, working on a book on the Assembly, which came out, I believe, in 1985, called The Assembly of the Lord. Mm. And historically, the historical content of that book is excellent. There are two sort of standard histories of the Assembly, one by Alexander Mitchell called The Westminster Assembly, and one by William Hetherington, who was a Free Church of Scotland historian, which has been recently reprinted.
That's fantastic. I mean, we'll put links to those books hopefully in the episode description so our listeners can find them and add to their library, and better yet, add to their knowledge of the Assembly, this important historical event, especially for Reformed folks and Presbyterians. Dr. Spear, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, and I thank you for writing this book. I think it's going to be a wonderful influence and a helpful reminder to our listeners of the importance of the doctrine of the church and how we go about understanding how God has decided to govern his body. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we thank you. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. I do want to mention, of course, some places people can find us. First, you need to get a copy of this book. It's Covenanted Uniformity in Religion, The Influence of the Scottish Commissioners on the Ecclesiology of the Westminster Assembly, published by Reformation Heritage Books. You can find that online in a number of places. Check out our partner, WTSBooks.com, for a good price, no doubt. Of course, you can find Jeff and Nick online at various places. FeedingOnChrist.com is one. You can find Nick online at NewCovePres.com. And you can find all of us online at ReformedForum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, so ways to subscribe, ways to download all of our previous episodes. And check out our archives. You can find many other conversations on different issues relative to the Westminster Assembly. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.